This is the IBJ podcast for the week of August the 9th, 2021, brought to you by Resultant, formerly KSM Consulting. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Before the Delta variant and the most recent wave of COVID infections began demanding our attention, this was shaping up as the summer of natural disasters, all believed by the scientific community to have been influenced by man-made climate change. For example, in June, cities in the Pacific Northwest were slammed by an intense heat wave, posting their highest temperatures on record. For example, it was 117 degrees in Salem, Oregon. And parenthetically, we should note that in February, you probably remember, Texas posted record cold temperatures that resulted in widespread failure of the electricity grid. Dozens of massive wildfires are still burning in the western United States, so far torching nearly 2 million acres of land in 14 states and sending smoke literally all over the country. Germany experienced a two-day monsoon that flooded tens of thousands of homes, disrupted power supplies, killed nearly 60 people. We saw similar flooding in China, Uganda, and India. Meanwhile, it's been a pretty typical summer in central Indiana. If you just want to focus on this year, forget recent droughts and other extreme weather events, you might be tempted to think that Indiana might be spared some of the more severe effects of climate change. Maybe we should congratulate ourselves for settling in kind of a Goldilocks area. Not too hot, not too cold. Everything's going to be just right. Well, the tricky thing about climate change is that all of the world's weather is connected, and the ripples created by the well-documented rise in global temperature can manifest anywhere as a severe problem. Now, I wanted to know in what ways climate change is impacting Indiana right now, and what are the greatest risks for serious disruption in our economy and way of life in future decades. So I called Jeff Dukes, the director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center and a professor of forestry and natural resources, as well as biological sciences at Purdue University. Since 2004, the center has been bringing together experts in many different fields and disciplines to gain a fuller understanding of the causes and impacts of climate change, and it performs regular, in-depth assessments of how climate change will affect specific industries. Here's our conversation. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Jeff Dukes, director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center. Thank you so much for making time today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
And today in central Indiana, it's 85 degrees, partly cloudy, with a 10% chance of rain, and the same forecast going for as far as the eye can see. Is it possible that Indiana is going to be spared some of the more severe effects of climate change?
Well, I wouldn't congratulate ourselves too quickly, but I think that Indiana is likely to experience somewhat milder effects of climate change than some places. We're not going to have the dramatic increase in wildfires in the near future that we're already seeing in parts of the West. You know, we don't have to worry about as much about hurricanes and their intensity changing. Jury's still out on what's going to happen with tornadoes under climate change. That's not so clear. And we do expect the climate in Indiana to get hotter. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that we're going to be spared all impacts, and precipitation changes are going to be important too. I'm sure we'll talk about this more, but I would say that, you know, relative to many places, yeah, Indiana is potentially better off, and it's possible that we'll see people in areas that are more starkly affected, moving to places like the Midwest. I do think that's a possibility, but that doesn't mean that we won't feel the impacts and that we shouldn't be preparing for them, because there are going to be some pretty major changes that are really already underway. And we can't just lull ourselves into complacency by saying, hey, we've got it relatively good.
Now, for the purposes of this conversation, we don't necessarily need to spend a lot of time proving that these events have been caused by human activities, such as fossil fuels, burning fossil fuels and deforestation and urbanization. I know there's skeptics who are saying right now, guess what? Extreme weather events are natural. They're normal. Can Absolutely. We just say, to the best of your knowledge, as somebody who studies the climate for Indiana's greatest STEM university, that human activities have disrupted the natural climate and at least exacerbated extreme weather events?
Oh, there's no question. There's no question. Yes, we've had extreme weather events always. And yes, every summer we could say, we could talk about this wildfire or that hurricane. But there is no question that human activities have dramatically changed our atmosphere in ways that are increasingly obviously changing the climate and causing these problems. So the science is really clear. It's really solid. It's been going on for many decades. And we've known this for many decades that this was likely to happen if we kept pumping more heat trapping gases into the atmosphere. And we've been looking for it for a long time.
So you mentioned that there are changes already underway in Indiana's climate. And I know of a few just by looking at your center's research. And the first one is that, I think, as you said, temperatures are rising. Since 1895, it's reported Indiana's statewide annual average temperature has risen by like 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit, which doesn't seem like a whole lot. But what are the projections? If we look forward to maybe 2050.
Yeah.
How is that going to affect the state?
It doesn't seem like a whole lot. I mean, we've updated that to 1.3. It's been warmer lately and whatever. It's been a couple of years. But yeah, it still doesn't sound like a whole lot. We've actually seen less warming than a lot of other parts of our continent and parts of the world. We expect by mid-century to have about 5 degrees warming Fahrenheit over the historical record. Now, under a worst case scenario, that could be maybe 6 degrees warming. Some of that warming is already included in the degree plus that we've already seen, but essentially we are on a warming trajectory, and we expect that that warming is going to accelerate over time. It's interesting to wonder about why we've seen less warming than other places. Part of it may be our agriculture. We've got crops being planted more and more densely over time. The farmers are doing such a good job of that, you know, growing more and more food for us, essentially, and vegetation on the landscape that's acting like a big swamp cooler and cooling our region of the country, we think. And there's a limit, unfortunately, to what they can do with that. So we're going to see these global impacts of warming increasingly affecting us right here at home. And one other thing I'll say is that, you know, you say a degree doesn't sound like much, and even maybe 5 degrees doesn't sound like, you know, all that much, but this is an average. This is a long-term average. And when you change the average, you're also dramatically changing the extremes. You're changing those high temperature days. You're making them all the more unbearable. You're changing the length of the heat waves that we get and making them much longer. You know, the length of time you spend over 85 or 90 or 95 degrees suddenly starts getting much longer, making those heat waves much deadlier. So there are serious implications of this. The good news is, you know, we do, because this is man-made, we do have some influence on exactly how much warming we're going to see mid-century or especially later this century. But the bad news is a lot of it's already baked in. So we need to be preparing for, you know, a substantial fraction of that warming actually happening. We won't be able to avoid much of it.
What do you do to prepare for another 5 degrees of temperature?
Yeah, you think about things like heat waves and whether people are going to be safe in heat waves. You know, how many people have air conditioning? Of the people that don't, do they have somewhere to go? Are there cooling centers available to them? Where are vulnerable populations, and what can they do when those really hot days come? And then, you know, there's lots of other things you think about. If you're a business, you recognize that the business decisions that you're making today that have to do with long-term infrastructure, they can't be made based on our historical climate. You can't say, you know, if you're building something that historically was designed to be in the climate that you're in, you can't just say, oh, well, we're going to rebuild that exact thing and it should be fine for the next 40 years, because that's not the climate it's going to experience. So, you know, in some cases that is maybe a trivial decision. In other cases, it's something like, okay, we have this culvert that's washed out. We need to replace it, or we have this, I don't know. So, you know, pick your piece of infrastructure. We have this asphalt we've laid down. Is it is it still going to be good in the floods of the future or in the heat waves of the future? And that, I think, is a challenge that sort of cuts across society, is that thinking about conditions that don't exist now.
Yeah.
How do we prepare for, or how do we envision ourselves living in that future climate? And we need to understand what that climate is pretty well, I think, to be able to plan for it. And we're in our center trying to provide information that can help our state. And it's not just heat, it's also the flood. So one thing we didn't talk about yet really is the change in precipitation. And in Indiana, that's even more dramatic than the change in temperature, I would argue. So yeah, we've increased 1.3 degrees temperature over the last 125 years or so. But we've also now gotten much, much wetter over that period. So we're getting, more than 6 additional inches of precipitation per year on average in this state. And the projections going forward are that it's going to keep getting wetter, and that additional water is going to come in the spring and the winter, which are the seasons when we don't have plants to really take up that moisture. So it's going to be running off. It's sort of useless to us, unfortunately, during those seasons, other than it's more of a nuisance than a help, I guess, is maybe the way to put it. And so we've got a plan for bigger storms. And we're also seeing already that a lot of our precipitation is coming in heavier events, that the heaviest rainfall events are getting heavier. Unfortunately, those are the ones that we have to sort of design our infrastructure to deal with, because that's when the flooding happens. It's when we get those really heavy events, and we have to have, culverts that can handle that, for instance. And we've already seen in the Midwest a dramatic increase in the amount of rain that's falling in the heaviest events. It's somewhere around a 50% increase in water in those events. And so that's a lot more water to deal with in our storms. And we have to be thinking forward and making sure that we're planning for that as well, if we want to avoid massive damages downstream from big floods.
I think one of the things that has popped up is that the number of frost-free days is getting steadily greater. What does that mean?
That just means the growing season is going to get longer and is getting longer. So if you think about it, during the winter, you get freezes, you get days that are where we get freezing cold temperatures. And sometime in the spring, you have your last freezing cold temperature of the year. And then you have a nice period where you don't have to worry about freezes, or they don't happen to happen until sometime in the fall, when you have your first freeze of the fall. Well, that period is getting longer. That growing season is getting longer because the winter, the periods of those freezes are just getting shorter. And that means we can grow different species. Different species can live here. You have the opportunity to grow different crops potentially if you're a farmer, or you might be able to think about growing multiple crops in a season in parts of southern Indiana in the future.
Here's the thing that freaks me out about that. Ticks. We've been told that we need super cold winters in order to kill the ticks who burrow underground and somehow insulate themselves. And then when you have a warm winter, they pop right back up again and say, hey, what's going on? Where's the blood? So I'm worried about warmer winters.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of species that has more to do even with the coldest temperature of the year. So, what is the coldest temperature of the year on some night in January? Maybe it's 8 below or something like this, or on a cold, really cold spell, maybe you get to, 15 or 20 below. That can kill off a lot of these species too, not to mention a lot of plant species. And as we warm up, that average coldest temperature of the year is getting warmer too, which is allowing more species to live around us. And whether it's ticks or maybe even more likely to be like mosquito species that we really don't want to see because they can carry different diseases, or some of these invasive insects or weeds. Yeah, that can lead to problems for us, absolutely. And we will see different species coming into the state over time as those temperatures increase. We think that there's going to be about a six, as there's going to be a 5 or 6 degree increase in our average temperature, there's going to be about a 6 degree increase in our coldest temperature of the year, which is going to permit new species to come in. We're going to have to be on our toes in terms of our healthcare system and recognizing new diseases we may be fighting, and potentially managing mosquito populations in ways that we hadn't been previously. At the same time, though, I want to look at the other side of that coin and say, it's also going to mean you might be able to grow some new species in your garden or in your farm. You know, there's this thing called plant hardiness zones, which are basically determining what garden plants you can have or what plants can grow where. It's just that, like, you know, a freeze will of a certain temperature will kill certain plants. And so we may be able to grow some species that we haven't been able to grow before. And so that could be kind of nice. So there's two sides of this coin. And I'm not trying to say that this is a rosy picture, but I am saying we should look at the whole picture.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ podcast.
The right data and technology solution can transform your business. KSM Consulting is now Resultant and still passionate about solving problems no one else can. Still collaborating with our clients to find the best answer, not the easy answer. Visit Resultant.com to see what's possible for your organization.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast. We're speaking with Jeff Dukes, the director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, about the ways climate change will affect Indiana and some of the state's most vital industries.
I want to look at a few of the industries, I mean, that really, Indiana has really adopted with enthusiasm. For example, you have tourism and recreation, well known as a popular destination for hiking and camping, bird watching, cycling, all kinds of outdoor spectator sports and festivals. So shifting temperatures and rainfall can either directly or indirectly affect the timing of these things, safety of these things. What are some of the lasting effects that our recreation and tourism folks need to watch out for?
I mean, okay, an obvious one is if you're in the ski industry and there aren't too many ski resorts in Indiana, but there are a few, it's going to affect the times when you can actually ski or make snow, that sort of thing. So, you know, our winters are shrinking, basically. But this is mainly about the timing of when you might want to do things. So our summers are likely to have more sort of unbearably hot days when people aren't going to want to be doing anything outside. The nice weather days are, depending on our sort of future emissions, they're gonna get pushed earlier in the spring and later in the fall, essentially. And so we might be thinking about, you know, moving the timing of some of the events that we hold that people enjoy so that it matches the times of year when the climate is right for them. Under really warm conditions, we're expecting we'll have a lot, or in a high emission scenario, I should say, in a future with a lot more emissions, we'd expect that we'll have a lot fewer sort of pleasant days per year outdoors. And that's one thing that sort of depresses me a little bit. It's like, I don't want to see those really nice, nice days go away. I love being outdoors. Hopefully that won't change that much if our emissions globally aren't huge, but I think generally we will be losing some of those pleasant days per year in this future, and our nicest outdoor days are going to move a few weeks earlier in the spring and a few weeks later in the fall on average.
The number of days that could be above 95 could increase substantially.
Yeah, that's right. That in a high emission scenario, and hopefully that's a worst case scenario, but summers essentially become unbearably hot. It becomes unpleasant to go outside for, you know, July and good portions of June and August. And that's just not a future that I want to see. It is a pretty dramatic change there. I'm hoping that we don't end up going down that trajectory, but we still have to expect that we're going to see much less pleasant conditions in midsummer.
Let me ask about agriculture. We grow a lot of soybeans. We grow a lot of corn. How are the consistently warmy temperatures going to affect the big crops in Indiana?
Unfortunately, it's not a good projection there. So we can't make a perfect prediction about how changing temperatures are going to affect crops. And over time, farmers have gotten really good. I mean, our crop yields have increased. And so the farmers are doing a great job of figuring out how to grow more crops. But these changes are going to make their lives more difficult. We don't know what varieties farmers will be planting in the future. But if they were using the current varieties of corn and soybean, we expect that the yields of corn and soybean would decrease by 10 or more percent typically It's a combination of the heat and the change in precipitation. So the drier growing season is not helpful. And the really warm conditions during the growing season are also not helpful for yield.
I'm thinking about livestock back on our old family farm. They weren't super excited when it was over 90 degrees. I assume that this could stress livestock and create and potentially deadly situations for them.
Right. Once you get above the mid 80s, you have to worry about keeping livestock cool. And so there are basically for producers, they're going to have to think about increasingly going to have to think about, are there places they can go for shade? Are there ways, are there maybe cooling pads for hogs to lie on? What are the options that we have for making sure that that our animals aren't overheating? And this could just mean in some of these operations where all the animals are housed, it could mean larger air conditioning bills, essentially. This is something that producers are certainly going to have to be thinking about because it's going to directly affect them. And they need to make sure that they've got adequate cooling power in their facilities so that their animals are comfortable.
Yeah, you bring up energy, which I assume would be another industry that would have to make some changes or would have to be able to shift with either greater or lesser energy consumption during the summer or winter.
Yeah, the energy industry is affected in a couple ways. And certainly demand is part of that, right? With hotter summers, we expect that people will have more demand for electricity, for cooling their facilities, their houses or their businesses. And really, this is probably going to affect commercial institutions more than residential institutions, right? It's going to affect businesses more than homes because businesses operate during the day and need to keep things cold during the day. There are a lot of businesses that need to keep produce cold or whatever, you name it. So there's a lot of refrigeration needed by business. At home, in Indiana, we have more demand on the heating side. People need to heat their houses in the winter and need to keep them warm enough at night. So those demands are going to decrease a little bit, but the summer cooling demands are going to increase even more. And exactly how that balance looks is different in different parts of the state. And in Southern Indiana, there's going to be a more dramatic increase in demand for cooling, but people do already have the infrastructure in place to cool things in Southern Indiana. In Northern Indiana, there's going to be a lot of warming and there's a decent number of people who don't really have much installed to do that cooling now because they haven't historically needed it as much. But I want to talk about one other change in energy that's maybe even more dramatic, which is on the production side. I mean, I think as we realize the potential consequences of climate change and how we need to mitigate the problem. We need to minimize the changes that are coming. We're increasingly going to be moving away from the energy mix that we have today and into an energy mix of the future where we're not generating carbon dioxide and heat trapping gases. And the good news is that for renewables, at least, they not only have the climate benefit of no emissions, but they're also rapidly becoming cheaper, substantially cheaper than our sort of traditional energy generation methods. And so right now in many parts of the state, installing new renewable energy generation is cheaper than running existing old technologies. So we're already seeing a pretty rapid shift in some parts of the state towards renewables. And I think that that's going to accelerate over time and you know, partly because of climate change, but a lot of it will just be due to economics. But the climate change benefits from that will be big.
Let me ask you about those of us who live in an urban area. How are we going to have to adjust to the increased heat, increased precipitation?
In urban areas, we're really going to feel the heat and the precipitation because there's not as much vegetation that can either take up the precipitation or turn the heat into evaporated water, essentially. So vegetation cools down an area by evaporating water and mitigates flooding by taking up water from the ground. So cities are not good at doing either of those. Typically, if they don't have a lot of trees, don't have a lot of vegetation, you end up just feeling the full brunt of the hot days that you experience. The buildings just radiate back the heat and the ground radiates back the heat, and that basically puts people in danger on the hottest days. And depending on the stormwater infrastructure, you know, they may or may not be capable of handling the heavier downpours that we're expecting. So how do you deal with that? I think one great way of doing that is thinking about trying to add more vegetation, more parks, more places where water can get into the ground and be taken up by plants and then be used to cool the atmosphere by those plants, right? So, I mean, the good news is that these are people generally like parks, they like green areas. And so if we can find ways to put more parks and green areas into the landscape in creative ways, we can use them to ameliorate flooding and to make our cities just feel much more livable on those hottest days.
I know when, I'm not sure I'm going to get the right city here. I'm going to say Houston, though, was hit by a hurricane. Definitely was a Texas city. They discovered that, I mean, they had so much hardscape in the city that, I mean, parts of the city just flooded because the water really had nowhere to go. Are we in Indianapolis or central Indiana, are we going to be more conscious of flood zones or even, I mean, take a second look at our flood zones?
Yeah, that's really important to do because we are expect that our flood zones are growing with this change in climate. And there have been some analyses that really back that up. And it's not just the heavier rainfalls that we're getting and the shift in seasonality, but there's also things going on like, you know, we're putting in more and more impermeable surfaces, more and more hard surfaces that just allow water to run straight off into the rivers. We're also putting in more and more agricultural tile, which is basically an underground drain for agricultural fields that allows the water to quickly drain out of the field and go into ditches and then into our rivers, which makes them rise faster after heavy rains. And then at the same time, we're building more in floodplains and we're sort of constricting our waterways, which also means that those rivers are going to rise faster for a given amount of water that's flowing through them. So all these factors together mean that we have the potential for a lot more of our infrastructure to be at risk from flooding as we go forward. And so, yeah, I think it's really important that we take a hard look at that and that we're not relying on old flood maps for sort of current insurance or future insurance projections or for decisions about building. And this is something that there's a lot of talk about this in the engineering community in the state about how we need to do this. But I think that we still need to see the action. We still need to see the changes get made in terms of making sure that our flood maps are updated and making decisions based on those new realities.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for answering some of these questions and giving me a better sense of what's going on.
Mason, thank you. It's been great to talk with you.
My thanks again to Jeffrey Dukes. Now, folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are some strong stories in this week's print edition of IBJ that I want to draw to your attention. The Central Indiana Community Foundation, one of the area's biggest grantmakers, announced in April 2019 that it was adopting a strategy focused squarely on equity and anti-racism, more than a year before the cultural sea change inspired by the murder of George Floyd. IBJ's Leslie Bonilla Muniz explores the strategy's influence and impact so far. Also in this week's issue, John Russell explains how businesses are taking the lead with mask and vaccination requirements in a political environment in which many elected leaders are loath to impose any mandates. Emily Ketterer sheds light on the massive backlog of appeals in the state's unemployment assistance program. And don't miss the members of the inaugural class of IBJ's latest honors program, 20 in their 20s. We've assembled a group of up-and-coming leaders whose accomplishments are so impressive we couldn't wait until 40 under 40. Again, you can find these in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week. Thank you.